everyone. This is my name is Santiago Siri. I'm a co-founder of Democracy Earth. We're a non-profit organization that basically tries to understand what democracy is in the information age. And we have been doing a bunch of crazy democratic experiments over the last 5 years. We tried everything from liquid democracy, direct democracy, participatory budgeting, qualitative voting, you name it. And we work with all kinds of organizations. We work with political parties, we work with parliaments, congresses, non-profit organizations, and also decentralized networks. And here's the thing that I can tell you after 5 years of doing democratic experiments. Usually when people go out there for a vote, it's because it's a very high-risk decision. And the higher the risk, the higher the need for legitimacy. And when it's a contentious decision, there's also a lot of interest in trying to corrupt or subvert or manipulate the decision-making process. So over these 5 years, we have also been hacked a lot of times. And democracy is one of the most hostile environments to deploy systems. So we learned a lot. But today I want to talk about the core of the problem, that is in decentralized networks. We know very well what happened with centralized networks. With centralized networks, there's one company, one Silicon Valley corporation that broke democracy, and that's Facebook. And the reason Facebook broke democracy is simply because they were the best ones at formalizing humans on the web. And that means that Facebook today has a database with 2.7 billion people, larger than the Chinese government, larger than any government on earth, and now they're even considering doing their own currency. So when you become the largest repository of identity with people taking selfies, training your face AI algorithms every day, you'll likely end up breaking whatever technology is, precedent technology democracy is being made with. Now, when we look into blockchain space, there's a tremendous amount of innovation happening, but there's one key missing ingredient which the web got in an authoritarian way, which is identity, humans. Where are the humans in the blockchain? We are lacking tools to formalize humans over these networks. So the problem with this is that it's limiting the social impact of blockchains. Blockchains have been extremely good on the financial part of the spectrum of economic activity, but the promise of what blockchains can achieve in terms of transforming our society beyond finance, beyond capital, is not there. If we look quickly at proof of work, which inaugurated our whole space with the Satoshi's paper, the explicit mention of Satoshi in his paper in relation to governance, is one CPU, one vote. And it's basically one CPU, one vote is ruled by the machines, not by the people, ruled by capital, not by society. And this has, you know, this makes sense in the world of finance where privacy is a fundamental right, and this has bent the design of these protocols around finance and around protecting privacy. But at the same time, we're still witnessing how democracy is being disrupted and broken all around the world because of digital technology as well. So the potential of decentralized networks, of blockchain-based networks, to use the tremendous disruptive capacity of these technologies to improve our democracies or to level up our democracies for the challenges of the 21st century must not be lost. Now, when we look into proof-of-stake systems, something we all know here in this room is that proof-of-stake systems, voting with your money, and whoever has more money wins, is a plutocratic way of governance. And maybe this makes sense for private companies, where you want the largest shareholders with the largest skin in the game to have more influence in the decision-making process. And when it's about public goods, when it's about public infrastructure, not necessarily skin in the game is a good alternative to weigh the conflicting interests we find within society. And even if the skin in the game argument was to be put out there, sometimes investors have skin in multiple games. And sometimes you want some games to lose for other games to win. So skin in the game is not compatible when there's conflict of interest. An interesting case this year is in the governance of Aragon on one of the AGPs. This is a timeline when on the x-axis you see the different votes of people staking tokens on the AGP, and at the last minute a whale appeared, and that single whale pretty much took control of the entire election. None of the other votes became relevant because the whale simply waited until the last moment to decide how he, she, or it would allocate its tokens and bring the election in its own interest. So proof of stake can work for certain aspects, but it's at the end of the day a plutocratic way of governance. So here's the question that we're facing, and this is, I will make a disclaimer right now. I'm more confused than ever about this problem, about trying to figure out proof of human, which is what we have identified after 5 years of doing work at Democracy Earth as the core challenge to sort out in order to understand how we can do democracy over the internet. Is proof of human possible? Well, I'm now more confused than ever, but I'm convinced that if we get this, we will get all of these dApps that are that have tremendous potential. If we sort out proof of human, we will get democracy, universal basic income, portable credit, better alternatives to KYC, fair airdrops, even luxury communism, who knows. A lot can happen if we can do proof of human. I do know, I've been involved with some organizations, the Partido de la Red in Argentina, which is a party I had the incredible experience to found 8 years ago, the Partido Digital of Uruguay, which is exactly like the Partido de la Red in Buenos Aires, and they are running for the presidential election this year, or Andrew Yang, who is trying to make UBI. This is the demand side. These are the folks that will need a technology like proof of human in order to deliver on some of their promises and in order to take blockchain-based technology beyond the means of finance and start building technologies that can also bring solutions to society. But here's the principle that we must abide with. Here's a very important consideration that I think it's great that Edward Snowden in during Web3 in Berlin this year, he said this, and I think it was definitely the highlight of that extraordinary conference he gave in the summer. We don't need to verify the identity, we need to verify the right to use a technology. And this is a very important distinction, because if we put our identity on chain in an immutable ledger for there to live on forever, and if things happen and there's a totalitarian regime, then that totalitarian regime can abuse that information in very dangerous ways. So when we are working with identity, we're working with a very sensitive piece of information. But we need to prepare ourselves for the future. We need to design systems that can help us understand in what context, in a world of where computation will be far more abundant than it is today, which is far more abundant than it was yesterday, how will computation look in that world, and how in that world we can create systems that we are sure that we will not be taken away by AIs and all kinds of machines. And also, we must avoid recreating all over again Facebook or the Chinese Communist Party, which are the two largest threats to privacy and our identities in the world right now. When the web began 25 years ago, the web was also this dream of free information, of connecting humanity. No one envisioned during the 90s, even though there was a lot of people trying to make money, but no one envisioned that something like Facebook would come out of the web. And Facebook started breaking democracies way before Donald Trump. They started breaking democracies actually during the Obama election. Facebook was critical for the election of Obama. I guess society was not pissed off because after all it was the Americans using Facebook to elect an American president. But when the Russians are using Facebook to elect an American president, or any foreign power is using this Trojan horse to elect an authority over another country, then the very concept of the nation state starts blurring. The very concept of non-domestic intervention in each other's affairs is no longer there. So we are in a very new political reality and we must prepare ourselves for a world of abundant computation. Now, abundant computation is showing us something that is very scary, and is that the cheaper information gets, the more truth becomes manipulated. And I think an extraordinary example of this is deepfakes. Deepfakes, all of these pictures, all of these guys that you see here, don't exist. They have been generated by what is called a generative adversarial network, which is a is two machine learning algorithms or two neural networks that reinforce each other and learn from each other. And once the network is able to understand the properties of human faces, it can. Okay, I guess the HEV is in the room. Or they're actually in the room. I don't mind. I can talk louder among friends here. There might be some spies, but that's okay. the weird thing about this technique of GANs is that usually in technology there's this thing called the uncanny valley. And the uncanny valley in CGI, in computer graphics, the uncanny valley is that moment where you can the thing tries to be so realistic that you see, start seeing the glitches rather than the realistic attempts of the graphic or the 3D animation that you're looking at. In these pictures, there's no more uncanny valley. It's extremely hard to tell if these pictures have been generated or not by an algorithm. There are some tweaks that you can look very closely that might tell you that this has been generated by an algorithm, but otherwise, we have to prepare for a world where this can be done with any face in video format and also with our voices. And the better GANs get, the weirder reality gets. Now, this is not necessarily all bad. This actually can be weaponized to break existing political reality. An interesting example on deepfakes is the Andrew Yang campaign, which has a DAO called the Yang DAO, which I would encourage you to check it out and become a member. You have to pay 40 DAI to become a member of the Yang DAO. One of the first experiments that came out of that is doing deepfake videos about Andrew Yang. And I think this is brilliant because, you know, in a McLuhan, as McLuhan said, the medium is the message. Andrew Yang is this guy talking about universal basic income because artificial intelligence is going to take all our jobs. And we get to communicate this, displaying exactly what the power of artificial intelligence is doing with reality itself. So the medium is the message, deepfakes, let's use them to break existing political reality, but let's be aware that this can be used, this is the space, the world that we're going to be living in the next couple of years. Another big problem for decentralized identity or verifying humans on chain is civils that might impersonate multiple identities. Usually a technique to prevent this is using reputation algorithms. PageRank, a very well-known reputation algorithm that gave us Google. But the problem with reputation algorithms is that they are really, in mathematical terms, algorithms of centrality. They identify, they start making more nodes more central than other nodes, so it starts centralizing all over again when what we want to achieve is a decentralized protocol. Then there's how we store identities or how we index these identities. If we narrow down identity to a one-dimensional piece of information, whether it's a username or an address or any kind of one-dimensional identifier, whoever has no knowledge of that the list of addresses can become can start exploiting this information in an Orwellian way. So maybe we have to also think about how we store the information related to identity or how we refer to identity in digital space. So because I'm very confused, what I thought I'm going to do here at DevCon is just show you everything that I've been looking around that's happening that's trying to do a proof of human approach. And these are all prototypes or very interesting demos and experiments that are trying to take different angles of how we verify humans over decentralized networks. So a very nice experiment is Humanity DAO. Humanity DAO is a token curated registry. You stake tokens and you nominate candidates, and these get approved or disapproved, or you can challenge existing candidates by using a simple token economy. Humanity DAO is based on Twitter, so you evaluate the candidates by looking at their Twitter profiles, and if their Twitter profile looks like it's a unique human, then you can vote in favor of that profile. It has some bugs. I was able to generate 5 identities with it, simply changing the username of my Twitter account. But it is a first step. It is a nice first step where we can start playing, well, how can TCRs help with this or not? And I encourage you to check out Humanity DAO and play with it yourself. It's already live on the mainnet. An evolution of this approach, this is still under the wraps. I think it's still being worked by the team of Kleros. We at Democracy Earth, we are collaborating with them, is to do a web of trust with using TCR with video proofs. The interesting thing about Kleros is that it introduces an element which I think is very important for evaluating these proofs, which is randomness. If you look at PageRank, in PageRank you will end up having validators that gain more reputation than other validators, and as you gain more reputation, that means that maybe in the future you can bribe those highly reputable validators, and those highly reputable validators can corrupt the system. So we need to do a system where randomness is an important element, and the jurors or those who are evaluating the proofs cannot be predicted, because they are the consequence of sortition, which is one of the properties of the original Greek democracy, sortition. And Kleros is definitely the one technology in the space that is really playing with randomness and electing jurors to evaluate evidence in very interesting ways. And they are working in the direction of helping figure out how to do proof of human. Another approach, which I think is one of the most approaches in this space, is doing synchronous Turing tests. This is a project from Russia called IDINA. And what IDINA has identified is Turing tests that are machine learning resistant, or that are very hard for computers to do, but very easy for humans to do. And here is a very simple example. They call these flips. So you have two flips. The same 4 images on each strip, and in one of the images, the correct is the right order, and the order is correct, and in the other image, the order is not correct. So you have to decide which one is right. Usually, you can do this right now yourselves. Usually, humans get this right 95% of the times, over 90% of the times. Computers get this right 70% of the times. Why is that? Because we humans, we have the cultural background to understand what might be the narrative or the story of the cat and the flowers and what might be going on there. Computers might be able to recognize some of the patterns inside the pictures, but computers don't have the cultural background to understand how these pictures go together. So this is a very interesting exercise. And this has led to the guys of IDINA to be able to actually research, and here's another one if you want to do it, to actually research machine learning resistant Turing tests. They have found out that these types of tests, they need to have certain properties to be machine learning resistant. One is these problems need to belong to what is considered AI hard problems. AI hard problems are problems that do not consist of pattern recognition. Anything that is based on pattern recognition can eventually be exploited with an algorithm. These are problems that require abstract thought or some kind of insight that it's harder for a machine to grasp. Also, this means that these problems must not be generated by an algorithm, because anything that is generated by an algorithm can be reverse engineered. So these need to be problems that are created by humans and not by algorithms. So what IDINA does, is they put these Turing tests in the network, and participants of the network have to solve these Turing tests at the same time. So this is how they prevent civil attacks. They have a party, where, let's say, actually the next one is in 2 days. You can go to the IDINA website. Thanks. Yeah, you're not with the KGB, I guess. Or the FBI. Yeah, I'm the FBI is, won't get into that. You can get me outside. But so you get people solving a problem that is easy for humans, hard for machines at the same time, because this Turing test party solving problem party is happening in simultaneous in a synchronous event. You might have a genius that is able to solve 3 or 4 or 5 of these super fast, but that's why it's not exactly a proof of human protocol, more of a proof of personhood protocol. You might get some seagulls, but because it's the resolution of these problems happens at the same time, it prevents the civil attack problem. Assuming that these Turing tests are still hard for machines to figure out. I think that we need to look deeper into this type of Turing test. I think there can be more creativity on how we think about this. But this definitely is a very interesting approach to this problem. Another approach, which is still theoretical, but I'm going to show later a practical implementation of some of these ideas, is researching your social graph. There's a very good paper by Glenn Weil called Verifying Identity as a Social Intersection, consists on evaluating your social graph, assuming that identity is a consequence of the different social intersections or the different groups we are a part of. And it's interesting because, for example, usually in cities, a lot of people will belong to a lot of groups, so you will have many, many narrow intersections, and each one of these intersections will describe a part of your identity, whereas in rural areas, usually a lot of people belong to the same group. So you have few populated intersections, whereas in cities you have many intersections with few people in them. And that's the difference between living in a city and living in the countryside. Intersectional identity is a pre-formal way of identity. And the claim of this paper is that we can formalize some aspects of this identity model and start basing identity or creating even a new political subject that is not directly linked to the individual, but it's also linked to its communities or its multiple communities, which is an interesting approach. I would recommend checking out this paper. There's an implementation of some of these ideas on this protocol called BrightID. BrightID, you have a score which begins with 0, and you start making handshakes with trusted contacts. And if those contacts belong to a group, and you 50% of the group you have already established a connection with, and you become a member of that group, that will feed your score, your civil rank score. And BrightID is an implementation of graph analysis. And through graph analysis, establishes a score that tries to estimate your the likeness of you being a unique human. So they have a working version on that you can download and play with it. Then there's something that we ask ourselves is, can we actually piggyback government infrastructure? What the piece of information provided by governments, which have already done a lot of the proof of work to determine that you're a unique human, in a way that we don't reveal information about the government. So maybe a technique is showing that you own a government-issued ID, and you take the typical picture you do in a KYC of your face and showing your government-issued ID, but with a technology that is able to automatically blur from that government ID any bit of personal information. The same technology that can automatically blur bits of information in your government ID is the same technology that can actually paste new information into that government ID. What we want to verify is not necessarily who you are or what specific information that is personal about you in that ID. What we want to verify is that you hold a government-issued valid ID. we don't care about your name or username or your surname or your address or anything like that. We only care that you are a legitimate holder of a government issued ID. But you know, this technology can also be used for other purposes. The other is thinking with hardware, not only thinking about this with software. Using tracking devices that never ask for any kind of personal information. You know, a technology like this thing that I have here that is constantly tracking my movement around the planet or my movement around the streets and can, you know, kind of estimate that I'm actually moving around this world and so makes sure that, you know, either I'm a living being, might be a way of trying to use that bit of information then to mine some kind of proof of humanity, assuming that this hardware is untamperable, which is a big assumption. But you know, these are some of the ideas of what's happening with proof of human. So looking at all this, looking at everything that's happening, and all of these implementations have trade-offs. Some are easier than others, some are cheaper than others, some are more specific. We figured, well, let's not just focus on one specific approach, let's try to find out how we can work with all of these different approaches and come up with a common denominator or a common score that can help us weight these different ways of valuing identities. So, an idea that has been injected to me by Albert Wenger, actually, is going into the realm of thinking about identity in a probabilistic way. Not thinking about identity either on a, you are a human or not a human, but thinking an identity or humanity as a spectrum, and the chances of the likelihood that you're a human based on different certificates or different scores. So the problem of, basically why identity is very hard is because it's this thing that lives in these two universes that are, one is the subjective universe that consists mostly of our attention, and the other is the objective universe, and identity is something that lives in between this. So considering the proof of human things that I showed you before, we can see that in the objective side of the spectrum, basically we're doing claims as strings of bits, any string of bits. We have pictures, fingerprint, video, these strings of bits go from lower entropy to high entropy depending on how complex they are. And we have different verification mechanisms that rely on computing. Some rely more on computing, and the others rely more on attention, like APIs, timestamps, intersections, machine learning, Turing tests, and TCRs. So can we weight all this in a score that can help us make sense out of this? Something that, given any Ethereum address, I have some kind of heuristic that will tell me, okay, this address is likely to be 92% human, and then people can write smart contracts using that input in order to evaluate a credit or evaluate any kind of human-based service. But the thing that we need to ask is, if we're doing an algorithm like this, is who watches the watchman? Who is determining how this algorithm works? So this algorithm must not be simply a blind machine. It must be something that can take into consideration how we want to be observed. How we want to decide how we want to be observed, how we, our identity is the source of something that comes from a process that is legitimate. So to understand legitimacy, a technique that, it's interesting that we have been researching a lot at Democracy Earth is quadratic voting. And how many of you here are familiar with quadratic voting? Okay, I would encourage you to read about it. Quadratic voting basically, you can vote directly on any issue by allocating votes, but the more votes you put on the same issue, the cost of that increases not linearly, but quadratically. So if you put two votes on something, it will cost you 4 tokens. If you put 3 votes, it will cost you 9 tokens. And this means that with quadratic voting, you are not only measuring the preferences of the voters, you're also measuring the intensity of those preferences. And a consequence of quadratic voting is that it tends to generate normal distributions of preferences. In tests we have done using Likert scales, Likert scale ballots, these typical surveys where you have strongly disagree, strongly agree, and values in between. When it's without quadratic voting, people tend to go to the extremes, to strongly disagree, strongly agree. But when it's with quadratic voting, we have these Gaussian bells, these normal distributions, and people tend to go closer to the center. So there's less polarization, and the data is has a much better organic distribution, which helps to which is better data actually for algorithms, for machine learning algorithms. We have done an implementation in quadratic voting, the first implementation in the US for the state of Colorado in the United States, and we got exactly that. We got an organic distribution of, we have 41 state legislators to decide over 107 bills, and we had an organic distribution of the, of how to rank these bills throughout time. So when we compare this with participatory budgeting, which is a linear distribution of tokens or votes, with participatory budgeting, legislators found that 50-60% of the bills had the same amount of tokens, so they were not able to prioritize among the long tail of bills. With quadratic voting, we were able to prioritize along a very long tail of bills. So we're working on bringing some of these ideas together. We're building a democracy DAO. I'm a member of Moloch DAO, so I'm going to put my shares of Moloch DAO subject to these democracy DAO experiments. And we, there's more to this, like zero knowledge proofs and ERC-725 identity standard. Come look for me on Twitter, I'm at SantiCity on Twitter. And there's a proof of humanity meetup if you want to come. It's tomorrow at 6 p.m. Take a picture of that, and we'll talk more about this. Thank you very much.